it's your client who had a sentence of 3 years in the Department of Correction, is that right?
Yes, and it was suspended and a fine.
But if we're talking about whether or not it's a criminal statute or a civil statute, do you mind starting with that?
That's approximately where I was going, all right. You know, I was sitting back there, my head's kind of spinning. I think that this sort of statute provides a good example of why there is a retrospective clause to fill in a gap. This offense, this statute, 566.150, carries a criminal penalty. It is a criminal penalty only to a certain class of people, that being anyone who has ever been or ever will be convicted of a sex offense. Now, ex post facto would be totally irrelevant to that statute because you're not looking at criminalizing conduct in the past. You're looking at one element that occurred in the past or a status that was bestowed upon you in the past by violating some sex offense. And whether the United States Supreme Court would find ex post facto applicable to 566.150 is fairly irrelevant because Missouri has a different clause, a clause that is so different only three or four states in the country have it, and that is retrospective, that a statute cannot retrospectively impose a limitation on your status or require some future conduct on your part. In one sense, as Judge Stith was saying, this is akin to registration. You're not putting your name on a dotted line, but you are expected to modify purely legal conduct simply by virtue of your prior sex offense. And it is an extraordinarily broad reach. This statute, last November, there was some discussion about the 500 feet. But the 500 feet is something of a perimeter around the park. It's not, has no bearing on the location of the playground or the pool. Now, the Judge Titelman brings up Forest Park. Not being from St. Louis, I'm not as familiar with that, but in Columbia, Rockbridge State Park goes on for miles and miles, and there are only a couple of playground areas at picnic locations. You could be 15 miles away in Rockbridge Park. Now, the question in that case may be, what is the knowing requirement go to? Is it you know that you're present in the park? From a plethora of cases interpreting what knowing means, I think that that would be the most reasonable target of the knowing, that you would not have to also know physically or yourself that there is a playground in the park. The statute certainly doesn't seem to say that. If that is what the statute...
What is, do you have the language there with you?
Of the statute?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it says anyone with certain offenses shall not knowingly be present in or loiter within 500 feet of any real property comprising any public park with playground equipment or a public swimming pool.
So it sounds like you'd have to know the park had it, but not necessarily where it was.
I suppose, you know, it's.
But you could argue it either way, but of course your client would get the benefit of the. any ambiguity.
I think, you know, I guess that's true. The knowing element in a number of statutes go to, you know, a broader sense than the specific. I'm trying to come up with one off the cuff, but I can't.
So it discerns the difference between a public park. For example, in St. Louis, we're a very faithful community. There's a church probably within 500 feet of anywhere. And so every church has its schools. I mean, they have their schools. They're not public, though. So it's a public park versus a school, an archdiocesan school that would have, obviously, playground equipment and children. They're not covered. So really, you don't have to worry about being too close to a school as long as it's not a public school or a public park.
So that is certainly true with respect
between public and private or parochial.
With respect to this statute, that's certainly true. The statute only reaches your conduct with respect to public parks and public swimming pools.
Is this statute different because it doesn't say you can't go near X or Y or Z, or cities can regulate and set out places which are too near parks, but it puts an obligation on the individual to determine where they can be, and therefore it requires affirmative conduct on their part in order not to be suddenly a criminal for having been near a place?
Yes. And I think that, you know, and the retrospective, what sets it apart from ex post facto is it does put an affirmative obligation on you because of something that happened in the past. In this case, and in RL and FR and Rainer.
And isn't the issue, is that what the people or the people who either drafted the document or voted to approve the document, is that or is it not what they intended? And isn't that the real issue as to what retrospective means? I mean, it was intended to cover stuff we've covered elsewhere, or it was intended to cover what we haven't covered elsewhere. One way or the other.
Well, and if it was only intended to do what the state proposes, it's meaningless. And neither this court cannot consider or impose upon the delegates or the people that adopted it a meaningless, irrelevant act.
And why is it totally meaningless?
Yeah, how would it be meaningless?
Retrospective?
It would have application in civil circumstances other than civil circumstances that impair contracts.
You know, I suppose that's true. I think that it's also true that it applies in places in a criminal context that is not reached by ex post facto.
And the state says that it's not, that ex post facto covers everything. Any legislative bodies or constitutional body wanted to cover in the criminal area. Is there anything that says or says the opposite? Is there any precedent to, how do we know what the technical meaning of retrospective is? I know Betheroom says that, but nobody has presented us with anything that came from to show that indeed was an acquired technical meaning.
Well, and Betheroom is an interesting case because the question of whether retrospective applied to a criminal matter was not really before that court. That court was deciding whether a particular remedy was available and whether a remedy could be taken away retrospectively. Now, there was dicta, I think, that clearly stated that court's understanding of what retrospective meant and that it didn't mean criminal. But as Judge Stith pointed out, that is simply a statement the court pulled out of the air. It's not provided any citation. And just 25 years later, the court in Kyle, which the state relies on as well, I think makes pretty clear that their understanding, not all that far removed and certainly predating this constitution that we're talking about today, said it cannot lawfully we think, dispense with any of those substantial protections with which the existing law surrounds the person accused of a crime. Statutes giving the government additional challenges, which authorized the amendment of indictments, have been sustained, but when the operation of those has not worked a substantial injustice to the defendant. I think Kyle is clearly applying the retrospective analysis to a criminal matter. It is not ex post facto to apply new substantive procedures because it's not a crime. You're not looking back and creating a crime. You're just looking back and changing the effect of that person's status, which is what the legislature is trying to do here. The legislature is trying to make you do an aerial flight, I suppose, over every state park in the state and look for playgrounds and swimming pools. Now then, you know, a particular sex offender may have to ask, well, this park doesn't have a swimming pool, but it has a swimming beach. Can I be in that park? And that the obligation for a given sex offender to know whether every park that he or she is going to enter or loiter within 500 feet. And loiter, this court in State versus Liermarker said, was looking there at the definition of linger and used the term loiter. The verb linger means to remain or wait long, to be slow in parting or quitting something, delay, loiter, or tarry. Well,
I think your time is up. Are there any other questions?
Well, an example would be, going back to Barnes Hospital, I know you're from St. Louis, but Barnes Hospital is, the third largest employer of the state of Missouri, or at least St. Louis. And they, if you're a sex offender and you work at Barnes Hospital, one could say some part of your job is loitering, waiting to do this. You can't be employed at Barnes Hospital, I assume, if you're a sex offender.
Are you loitering if you're having a cigarette outside a convenience store?
Or outside the entry to Barnes Hospital?
And do you know you're loitering? It conjures up far too many problems by putting this affirmative obligation onto...
But yeah, we don't want to trivialize what the legislature wanted to do, was protect the children in Missouri from sex offenders. It's a very, it's a goal that the legislature is trying to do.
It's a lofty goal, but one the people in adopting the Constitution have said can only be done looking forward.
Thank you.
At least in terms...
Thank you, Judge.
We'll hear from you again.
May it please the court, since this is the one case where we actually had a trial and have some facts, it might be helpful to point out that the issue of loitering, while an interesting one and one that might well be worthy of litigation when it's properly raised and briefed at some future date, doesn't even apply in this case because the defendant was convicted of being present in a park. And the undisputed evidence at trial was to get from the entrance of this park to the area where the defendant was, you had to drive past playground equipment that was clearly visible from the road. And there were also statements by the defendant that he had been in that park many, many times since he was a child. So I think there was certainly sufficient evidence for the state to establish the knowledge requirement of the statute. And in any case, the sufficiency of the evidence hasn't been challenged on this appeal. Now, I have to disagree with the idea that the Thurum, that language in there was dicta, because the court in that case was asked to decide whether the provision in question violated the ex post facto and retrospective provisions in the state constitution. Now, in order to decide that question, the court necessarily had to decide what the scope was of those specific prohibitions and whether they even applied to that particular law, and that's what the court did in reaching its conclusion. And I'd also note, as far as the Kyle case goes, that that case analyzed the law that was at issue there under the ex post facto clause, did not do so under the ban on retrospective laws. And the passage that's been discussed here and quoted really was a discussion of the legislature's ability to retroactively change procedural laws without violating the ex post facto clause. And as the Western District noted just a few years ago in the Rayford case, that the terms ex post facto, retrospective, and retroactive have a distinct and legally material difference in their meaning, and it distinguished retroactive and retrospectively by saying that a law is retroactive in its operation when it looks or acts backward from its effective date, and is retrospective if it has the same effect as to past transactions or considerations as to future ones. So to say that a discussion of retroactivity necessarily means that the court was finding a retrospective violation is, I don't think, an accurate conclusion to reach from that particular discussion. Now, as far as other sources that the court relied on in Bethurum to reach its conclusion, that the retrospective ban does not apply to criminal statutes, the court did look at two other states that had similar constitutional bans on retrospective laws, New Hampshire and Texas. And certainly to look at relatively contemporaneous interpretations of those constitutions to give meaning to the Missouri provision would be a proper thing for the court to do. The Texas court actually in D. Cordova versus City of Galveston looked at a constitutional provision that's nearly identical to Missouri's and concluded that retrospective was intended to cover cases not within the ex post facto and impairment of contract clauses, similar to what the Bethurum court found. And also similar to Bethurum, the court noted that a literal meaning of retrospective is no more expressive of the intent of the prohibition than the literal meaning of ex post facto. So going into the idea that these terms have a technical meaning and that the courts need to apply
those. What do we mean by technical? We mean something narrower than literal? Or does it mean it has an understood meaning in the law?
An understood meaning in the law, a term of art, if you will.
But that's where I'm confused. It could well have a term of art, like ex post facto is a term of art, and it means prior criminal it applies to giving additional punishments or prior criminal cases, but no one, you've done a very thorough job of talking about the cases, but no one is, but you, neither you nor the five fine attorneys on the other side have found any source of a technical meaning, at least that I can discern.
Well, again, it's
except for the discussion of Calder versus Bull.
I think Bethurum extrapolates on the reasoning of that, because somewhere, at some point in time, somebody decided that ex post facto is limited to crimes and punishments, or decided what the proper definition of that was.
And if this is the first one to do retrospective and we think it's good, then that's great. But then it's not relying on a technical meaning, it's creating one. And that's a different analysis, and we look at it differently, and if we think it's right or wrong.
Perhaps in some respects, since it seems to be the first Missouri Supreme Court case that put that meaning.
If our issue is what's settled law and what did they understand when they were doing it, we cannot assume that those writing that words for the first time understood it in a technical sense that wasn't created till it was interpreted years later.
I can say the court stated that these were long settled meanings and they didn't give the etymology of that.
I know you can't pull it out here, but it's frustrating for the court, I think, not to be able to find where it came from.
Frankly, that's reading a lot of these 19th century cases, they're not always as clear as you would like them to be on some things. I think the court explains itself much more clearly than they did back then. There was a question asked, let me see if I can find that page here, at the last set of arguments. When we talked about the 1875 Constitutional Convention, whether anything was said there about retrospective being limited to civil laws, I went back and looked. I did find it, but I've talked a lot about how the context in which things were said is important, and I want to be clear here. This is like the comments from the delegate named Gantt, because they were made by a different delegate named Cruz, who, like Mr. Gantt, was offering an amendment that was eventually rejected. So that's why I don't cite it in my brief. I don't rely on it to any great extent. But I do want to show that there was at least some sense of that understanding here. The amendment he offered actually would have put into the Constitution the definition of retrospective that was later adopted by this court in the Squaw Creek case and has been carried forward since. On page 376 of volume 2 of the debates, he, in referring to retrospective law, says, as a technical definition is obvious and well settled. Then on page 382, he says, a retrospective law, as is well known to every lawyer on the floor, is the very worst character of an ex post facto law. It means the same thing in respect to civil affairs that an ex post facto law does in respect to criminal matters. And perhaps the lesson to be learned from this is the fact that, well, of course, this predates Bethurum. But beyond that, once Bethurum was issued, I cannot find any evidence that there was any general outcry or sense that that decision was wrong or need to be changed.
And well, there doesn't seem to have been a case addressed to those facts either way.
Right, or that anybody tried to bring up a challenge to it as saying this is incorrect. But as I pointed out before, in 1945, the exact same provision of the Constitution was readopted without any debate or amendment. And I think what we can safely say about that is that the public wanted to keep the status quo in place. We had this settled interpretation of retrospective. No need was seen to go back and change that somehow. So there's no indication that that somehow was widely contrary to the understood meaning of retrospective as had been set down by the court.
How do you respond to the argument in Mr. Price's brief that says, oh, don't bother with what people thought about it back then. Just look at what it says and apply it.
Well, of course, that goes back to the very problem I think we saw stated in Bethurum and Calder, where if you apply the plain meaning with no limitation or restriction, it sweeps so broadly as to be almost unworkable. And again, as I said before, if you give retrospective such a literal interpretation, it pretty well writes ex post facto completely out of the Constitution. It actually writes impairment of contracts out of the Constitution. I think Mr. Gant was correct to that point, that retrospective can be given under a literal interpretation that broad in effect. But that wasn't the intent. And the ultimate rule that the court follows is to effectuate the intent of the voters in passing the Constitution. And, you know, even though plain language is one tool to do that, technical construction is another, as this court recognized just last year in the Ledbetter case.
But if I understand, I mean, basically your argument is, I understand your argument, if it were literal, it would be everything, so it must be something technical, mm-hmm. but not where you get the technical meaning that it means only civil. I don't see how that follows from the fact that we have to have a technical meaning, than you just think it's sort of good sense, that you wouldn't want to go further.
I think it's an understanding that ex post facto has always historically been intended to be the limit on retrospective criminal laws. And that we don't, as a historical understanding, we have never gone beyond that.
Whereas contracts could not be held to apply to all of civil laws, and therefore that would need something larger.
That's right. And of course, again, retrospective isn't in the U.S. Constitution, so you know the federal government, at least the drafters of the U.S. Constitution, didn't even find it necessary to go beyond impairment of contracts in dealing with civil matters. But the voters of this state and a handful of others have decided to at least give that little bit of extra protection to matters like taxation, etc.
Wasn't this provision in response to a situation where a political subdivision, not an individual, created a tax they imposed a tax that was collected that wasn't in existence when the year began. I mean, this provision wasn't intended necessarily to deal with as between individuals. It was intended to protect
right
from political subdivisions changing the rules of the game during the year.
That's right. And somewhere in all the reading I've done, I remember seeing a reference to the fact that retrospective wouldn't. The problem isn't relations between individuals, it's relations between the government and individuals, and that's what that is. So that kind of scenario that you mentioned certainly is what's motivated this particular ban.
That particular situation is discussed in at least one of the constitutional debates, isn't it?
Well, there was certainly a discussion about a road project, and that dealt with a different type of retrospective law, the confirmatory law, but certainly that, you know, that was a great matter of concern as to, you know, the government basically lopping a debt onto the citizens and then having that would not have been valid under the laws at the time, and then, you know, later would have been found to be valid. So that ultimately didn't make it into the Constitution, but definitely was a source of concern. And the retrospective going the other way in terms of invalidating things that had been valid in the past would be kind of the flip side of that coin, and certainly is what we've dealt with. I guess I'll reserve for any future remarks for the remaining cases, unless there are other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think I've said in this court before that research is not a science, and I can add to that oral argument's not a science either. In answer to Judge Stith of whether there is anything predating the theorem, there's not that I can find in Missouri, but I did find an 1868 case out of Iowa that was discussing New Hampshire's, or at least mentioned New Hampshire's ban on retrospective laws. And the citation is 26 Iowa 340, and that's the Supreme Court 1868. There the court said retrospective laws, as distinguished from ex post facto laws, are not in conflict with the United States Constitution, which is true. The constitutions of various states are understood to prohibit retrospective laws, and they mention the states. In the absence of any constitutional inhibition, it has been uniformly held that the legislature has the power to pass retrospective and retroactive laws. And then it it talks about that retrospective, a law should not be retrospective unless the legislature was clearly stated it in its act. Here it clearly didn't, but I think the distinction between ex post facto and retrospective is fuzzy. But retrospective, Missouri could have accomplished a great deal of comfort for all of us by omitting ex post facto and the ban on contracts by simply including retrospective. That, of course, was defeated.
But doesn't that get us to the argument of your opponent that if you take retrospective in its literal meaning, then it is so broad, it covers, unreasonably covers everything. And that takes me back to the question, is it a valid law, or under your definition of retrospective, could you pass a law that says convicted sex offenders can't be teachers?
Well, I think you can, but you can't say someone convicted 2 years ago can't be a teacher.
Of course, couldn't you say going forward that school districts cannot hire convicted sex offenders? Then you're regulating the conduct of school districts, not individuals, and you would accomplish the same purpose?
You would. Last November, there was a question, I think Judge Stith raised the hypothetical about whether the state could prohibit, I can't remember the exact, so I'll use a driving while intoxicated, you cannot have a liquor license if you have a DWI conviction, or the state can't issue it to you. But, and it's a crime to do it, to have a liquor license. If it applies civilly but not criminally, we have a situation where the state has to issue the license, but it's a crime to have it. And that creates a quagmire that has to be covered by the retrospective clause of Section 13.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your argument. Case will be submitted.